the bubble.
Hello and welcome to Burst the Bubble. You're listening to ChemFM with me, Chris Moten, and my regular co-host, Michael Quintario.
Hello.
And our guest this week, Mr. Richard Wareham.
Hello.
We're a show all about silly news stories. News that's sort of, kind of not news, but kind of news. It's sort of, it's an amusing thing, it's not an important thing. That's the sort of Venn diagram we're constructing here today. So, tell us, Richard, what is the story we're going to be talking about first today?
Well, the story we're going to be talking about first is an exciting story all about the Queen.
Yes.
That was very slightly informative.
It is slightly informative.
Can you inform us more?
Well, I'm trying to sort of tease the audience into sort of getting a bit of excitement, going, well, what about the Queen? Which Queen? Is this like a cunning play on words? And I'm talking about the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II. Actually, this is an old story, relatively speaking, in the sense that Queen Elizabeth, when she was, I think, 14... so this is a long time ago, was rather starved for entertainment. I mean, normally, a 14-year-old girl at this time, sort of pre-war, would have gone out to the theatre or to the cinema to entertain herself. But these options weren't open. Would have gone out to the theatre or to the cinema to entertain herself. But these options weren't open for the Queen. So, being rather excited and sort of am-drammy, the Queen decided to host her own pantomime in Buckingham Palace itself. And just has gone on the market recently a programme from this pantomime. So you can see all the characters that the Queen and the various bits of the royal household played.
Oh, I see. So were there any sort of... particular characters of note that they...
Here that the future Queen Elizabeth... she was 18, sorry. Played a character called Lady Christina Sherwood. And Margaret, who's her sister, played a character called Lucinda Fairfax. Now, I'm not interested in that. What I want to know is what did the Duke of Edinburgh play the pantomime dame? That's actually what I want. And if so, are there photos? Because I want you to imagine in your head the Duke of Edinburgh, you know, in the 50s when he was quite dashing, or maybe the late 40s is what this is. It was in the mid-40s, actually, 1944. I want you to imagine the Duke of Edinburgh daming. Wouldn't that just be awesome? I mean, his son's done it, right? His son, Andrew, has...
Was he as gaff-tastic in the old days? Like, are the gaffs something that he's developed, or were the gaffs always there? Because if so, his main gaff was a sexist gaff. And so, what would happen if he played the pantomime dame? Would they invert? Would he start making loads of really crude anti-male sentiments?
Perhaps he's just an amazing method actor. Have you ever thought about that? Perhaps in this pantomime, they said to him, oh, daddy, your character is to be a sort of crotchety old man who makes horrifically racist and sexist statements, because that would be hilarious for the pantomime.
Yeah.
And no one's told him to stop acting.
Are you getting confused over who the Duke of Edinburgh is? Because he's not daddy.
He is to the he's the Queen. Ah, yes, I was getting confused for a second. Gosh, that was... Well, perhaps that's what they say later at night, you know, who knows.
We are talking about Prince Philip, right?
Yes, we're talking about Prince Philip, yes.
Yes, okay.
Just 90.
He is still the one who says all the stupid things.
He is, yes, but he's not the Queen's father.
Well,
that's the most important
father.
Thing to note,
no.
Yes.
And probably wasn't around for the Queen's 14th birthday.
Well, no. Actually, she first met him when she was 13.
So he could have been.
Perhaps could easily. He was her chaperone.
Were they leads? Were they the male and female leads in the pantomime? Because that would be quite a weird way to...
So Duke of Edinburgh Damien is one thing, but playing buttons is quite another.
And if you're trying to construct some sort of charming romantic movie around this situation, then I think the ending of the movie would be frankly underwhelming, because it would be sort of, you know, their eyes met across, well, presumably across a stage. But then you'd have to, at the end of the film, cut 50 years later, and they're sort of opening a shopping mall in Bournemouth, and sort of going, this is what our lives have added up to.
I can't really see that being the sum total of their lives, to be honest with you.
Well, is there a lot more to it? Like, assuming that the sum of lots of opening a shopping mall is the same as just opening a shopping mall, you know, it's the best thing you've done that indicates the sum total of your life. I think the royal family is basically defined by allowing people access to retail complexes.
That's their main constitutional role, is it? I see.
Yeah. You can't enter a new retail area until a royal has been there and said, yeah, whatever.
So
carry on.
My college is actually opened by a royal. Does that mean my college is effectively just an exciting shopping mall? If that was the mall itself in London, opened by the Queen.
Yeah, there's kind of a chicken and egg problem there, isn't there? who opens a new royal palace?
Cause that, yeah, that's true, yes. Because the Queen can't be in it first, because it's not been opened. But,
the big chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, and which, you know, presumably there was a big chicken and a big comedy egg in this pantomime as well, like all pantomimes. I have this sort of memory in my mind that a particular pantomime is the union of all rather naff variety show performances. I imagine, what's the name of the guy with his big fake turkey that he sits on?
Well, Stuart and Emu?
No, Bernie something.
Matthews.
I can only think of either Bernard Matthews or Bernie Eccleston. Neither is the sort of person who's famous for sitting on a big fake yellow bird.
Well, one of them farms turkey, and the other one, I think, sponsors Formula One races.
He's for some reason in control of it. I've never understood why Bernie Eccleston is in control of Formula One. He seems to be a bit like the Queen in that regard. In the fact that I'm not really sure why the Queen is the Queen, except for the fact that she is, and everyone agrees that she is. Yeah. So I'm not really sure why Bernie Eccleston's in charge of Formula One and like says what goes on, apart from the fact that everyone agrees that he is, and he does.
Yeah, it seems like I think he's in charge because he has a big sack of money, but so do a lot of people.
I think Formula One is not lacking in people who have big sacks of money. Right. I can't imagine he's got a bigger sack of money
it
than
Ferrari.
It
seems like if you were the Sultan of Brunei, you'd be able to just buy the whole thing out and say, and from now on everybody races in clown cars. And then that's what the sport would become. I'd watch that sport.
I would, actually. Sultan of Brunei, if you happen to be listening.
Everybody raced clown cars and had these stupidly over-engineered things that are completely incapable of overtaking each other. I think that would be a really good sport.
And in a pit stop, like the little clown fire engine could come and like 13 people could come out of the one fire engine and like start looking at it. It'd be great. Yeah, sorry, Michael.
I'm actually looking forward to the other alternate spot we could get out of this, which is just rich people beating each other up with huge bags of money for the rights to be in charge of the
to be broadcast on the Socialism Network.
Exactly, a big meta sport. It's sort of like Gladiator for the right to spend all of your money, which it seems strange somehow, but there we are.
No, I was just imagining that. So if you have that much money in coinage, I mean, surely you like fill a sock or a sack with it and swing it, you can get some good.
Well, that's true, but then you can do that with £2 worth of 10p's, right? Or presumably,
oh yeah,
no, that can't be right. £2 worth of 1p's or £20 worth of 10p's.
I think that would be regarded as literally a cheap victory. It'd be like using the shotgun in Counter-Strike. You know, it's like using a sack of 1 penny pieces is just.
I'm sure that's how the commentator on the rich men beating each other up with sacks of money game show. They need a better title than that, really.
Yeah, it'd be sort of
a good pounding. Something like that.
Yes, Monito beatdown or something.
Exactly, exactly.
That's not very good.
Well, on this hypothetical show, I'm sure that's how they would describe such a move, like using the shotgun in Counter-Strike. the overlap of the Venn diagram of the two audiences of Counter-Strike and this money-based game show is just a circle.
Yeah.
Going back to the pantomime.
Back to the story, yes.
Back at the point.
Right up until now, just been imagining the sort of pantomimes you get in Village Hall across the land, apart from the fact that when you read the story, you find out that the music was provided by the military, and they had an Oscar winner making the sets.
Well, see, that's interesting, but you see, it didn't say at any point that it was an Oscar winner famous for making sets. So I just like to have the equivalent of Brad Pitt of the day come and just said, right, you're not actually in the pantomime. We just want you to chop some boards up and paint some backdrops. The same way, you know, it says the military provided the music, but that just mean, you know, the part of the military, presumably the military split into two main areas, right? There's the bit that makes music and marches around and is very pretty. And there's the bit that points guns at people and goes, bang, you're dead. Right now, I'm sure
that's not what they go.
Well, in my mind, it is. You know, I've seen enough World War II programs. There's a lot of bang, you're dead going on, I think. And what if they got the wrong bit of the military in? The bang, you're dead bit. I mean, they give a 21 gun salute, but it's not very musical, is it?
Yeah, it's sort of. You wonder at what point during your military training do you get divided into those two segments of military endeavor.
Of the shooting people and
playing the trumpet, yeah.
Presumably, they give you some sort of long and rather abstract metal device, and if you try to put it in your mouth and blow, they put you in the trumpet division. If you point it at people and go bang, 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 yeah, you're in the pointing at people and going bang division. And the important thing is that you just, they don't want people whose natural reaction to a long metal thing is to put it in their mouth, having guns. And similarly, pointing a trumpet at someone and going bang is next to useless.
Yes, so as long as
next to useless.
Next to useless, yes.
How would it be made more useless?
It would have psychological impact. You know, it's like if a whole regiment of people marched over the hill bearing trumpets and then pointed them at you and went bang, you'd be like, well, it's got to do something, right? I mean, clearly the army has invested a lot of resources into making that happen.
Well, I like to think that so there's an unwritten rule around, amongst men. Okay, so this only works if the armies are entirely men. So I know in this sort of wonderful modern world, that's not necessarily always going to be true. But there's an unwritten code amongst men that if you come across another man and you mime very slowly bringing out a gun, you then have to have a very slow motion gunfight. Okay, entirely in mind. Of which there will be a winner, okay, and there will be a very dramatic winner. So presumably the trumpet division does this. They bring out a sort of trumpet, obviously miming it to be a gun in slow motion. And all of a sudden the army goes, oh, it's a slow motion gunfight. And they go and have a slow motion battle entirely. And then one side wins, and the other one goes, oh, okay.
Are you genuinely asserting that's a thing and not just an episode of Spaced?
It is a thing, isn't it?
I was almost certain it was just an episode of a popular Channel 4 comedy.
Well, I've never seen Spaced, so it can't possibly.
Perhaps it's a genuine thing.
Yeah.
we'll have to have a slow motion gunfight outside the studio.
Perhaps Spaced was doing amazing observational comedy.
I'll see if it really exists. Yeah, I thought it was some weird thing they were making up.
No, obviously you're just not a man, Chris. If you've never done this. You know. If you've done this and you're a man, why didn't you email the show? Or if you've done this and a woman, why don't you email the show? Or if you've done this and you fall into a third category, email the show.
Maybe there's some equivalent. Tell us about the slow motion mime endeavours that you have engaged in.
How could they email the show, by the way, Chris?
Oh, well, they could email the show by emailing to the address that is studio@camfm.co.uk. Yeah. Alternatively, they could go to the website, which is www.camfm.co.uk.
Where I believe they can see a wonderful video of us.
They can see a what?
A video of us.
A video of us.
Well, it's like a
mapped those three words together into
It's like a static picture, but moving.
It is, yes. Yes, you can see the webcam. You'll be able to see the backs of our heads looking at these microphones. And the front of our heads for that brief moment there. If you didn't see that, you missed it.
But anyway, moving on from the pantomime, because I think we've rattled that story pretty nicely now. We move on to a different story, and this is another one of these. Well, it starts off as quite a heartwarming story, and then it moves into sort of one of those stories where you go, and then it's finally one of those stories where you realise there's a horrible, grubby undercurrent to charity endeavours.
And you kind of like go, oh, I used to think the modern world was a nice place to live, but...
And then your cynicism levels just go through the roof. Yeah. Exactly. So let's move back to the start of the story. So
let's be happy for a little while, at least.
On the off chance that there happens to be anyone listening to this show who was born in 1951, you will, of course, remember Brian the Snail from the Magic Roundabout. Now, of course, does anybody listening to the show happen to have been born in 1991, during the brief, 10 years before the brief resurgence of Magic Roundabout, you'll also know Brian the Snail from Magic Roundabout. For everyone else, the Magic Roundabout has got a snail in it called Brian.
You can look it up on the internet.
Exactly. And Brian is a sort of cartoon character snail. Now, a director of a charity, I think it's Action for Kids, although I must admit my brain has just gone slightly mad. Well, there's some sort of charity, I'm sure. Action for Kids, that's right, yes. Came up with the bright idea of doing a charity marathon dressed as a snail and getting sponsorship to do such a thing. Now, that's quite a normal charity idea. That, oh, yes, someone's going to run or walk a long way. And ho, 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 look, they're dressed in something ridiculous. It's a good old tradition in this country. And indeed, he managed to raise £20,000 doing this. Now, you'd think, gosh, that's very good. And when you find out that he's also director of fundraising for this Action for Kids charity, you think, that's astonishing. And he had to endure vomiting and cramps and dragging this Brian the Snail costume around the entirety of the course. Upon raising the £20,000, he was then sacked because the charity wanted him to raise £100,000.
I think I should point out also that this wasn't like running the marathon in a marathon costume. This is him crawling the marathon course as a snail over 26 days.
Absolutely. So this is some endeavour he's given himself here. I mean, he's a director of fundraising could just sit there and hire a lot of people with buckets and say, go forth and fundraise in a sort of very dramatic sort of Charlton Heston sort of go forth and do way. But no, he went out there. He literally crawled on his belly for these people and got sacked for his endeavours after raising a measly £20,000. Now you sit there and go, surely they can't sniff at £20,000. Well, when you find out that the charity actually made a loss.
Right, yes. Presumably the salary of the person doing this exceeds £20,000.
Exactly. And and the people who shake the buckets, they're employed. They had to hire the costume. They had to pay for all the permits to close various bits of the road. So in this sort of wonderful world of charity giving, if he had raised more than £20,000, it would have been a profit. But as it were, it actually cost the charity money to do this.
Yeah. So has he actually in some way decreased the amount of action that can be taken for kids?
He has. So ironically, as dressing as a snail and crawling around his berry, he's sort of promoted inaction for kids, which is presumably exactly what they don't want to.
So presumably this has revealed the thing we thought we knew already, which is that if you make something arbitrarily difficult, it doesn't make it more effective necessarily.
Exactly. And also that when you're giving money to charity, you've got to think, am I really giving money to charity, or am I just offsetting the cost of this ridiculous stunt that I'm causing me to give money to?
I'm just wondering, because he took 26 days to crawl as a snail around the course, whether they'd actually decide to fire him before he'd got all the way around.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. If they just left a note on his desk.
Yeah, and they're just waiting for him to get back. The P-45, or... Is it P-45? I think it's a P-45.
It has recently become increasingly obvious to me that no one in this studio has ever had a real job. he just failed to tell any of his immediate superiors about this. So he came back and they said, well, you're like 26 days late. What are you doing? We fired you. We've got Steve here. He's our new director of fundraising. What are you doing?
They'd have to be very careful if they decide to make a movie out of this, that it didn't get confused, because 26 days later is worryingly close to the title of a completely different movie.
No, that is true. That is, it's a good job he wouldn't spend another 2 days, otherwise I would have thought he'd be infected by the rage virus. Now, talking of things that make me rage, I believe we're going to have a musical break.
I think it probably is about that time. Our first choice of music today is to be blamed on Mr. Richard Wareham. we'll leave you to see and tell you later. We'll be back with more silly news in about 5 minutes' time.
On air and online. For students across Cambridge. Your station, your Cam FM.
Hello and welcome back to Burst the Bubble on Cam FM 97.2. We're a show about silly news stories. And we're going to commence this section by reading out a quick email that we've had during the break there. Rich, what have we got?
We appear to have an email from a regular contributor, 86.132.something-else.something-else, who also goes by the name of Clem, excitingly. I happen to know it's a she, says, I'd pay to see more people dressed up as snails for charity if it removed the harassers from our streets who accost us to sign up for monthly donations. Which is true. On a Saturday day in Cambridge.
I like the idea of like this crazy Saturday night with all the charity people out.
Exactly, yeah. They're like going off, shaking their buckets of people. He's going, ooh, charity people, but I can't arrest you because a policeman arrests a charity person that's bad in the papers. Ooh, damn you, modern world, for inverting morality. And then someone goes to the poor policeman who's collapsed in a heap of existential doubt and goes, well...
I'm not quite sure where that went then.
Yeah, that's like, how are you inverting morality here? Like, away from...
I can't arrest people who are making a public disturbance.
Oh, I see. Because the idea of charity being a fairly reasonable thing has presumably been a sort of a constant throughout human existence. Except for, like...
Charity people harassing you is not.
Ah, right.
I'm trying to say harass properly this time, because I discovered recently that harass, which
you
is
can't called, harass.
You can't harass is not the way you're supposed to say it.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, that was the big joke on Some Others Do Have 'Em with Michael Crawford, that he said, ooh, I'm being harassed. And everyone used that joke because that's the wrong way to say it. But then a certain generation thought that wasn't the way to say it. And
oh,
so we
see,
do.
See.
So it's an actual a vowel shift that can be traced to Michael Crawford.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit of factoid for you, a little bit of linguistic factoid for you there, audience.
Yeah.
But who was that we heard singing?
Right. Yes, indeed. So the song which I reiterate is to be blamed on our guest, Mr. Richard Wareham, was Kids by Take That. But we have an appropriate story related to that band, who recently found themselves... hoist up from their own petard, or rather from their own robot, which is not a phrase.
Hoist on your own robot.
Hoist on your own robot.
It should be the phrase of the modern age.
Because it is a rare circumstance to arise. But nonetheless, Take That were hoist from their own robot at a gig at the City of Manchester Stadium the previous weekend. When it appears that they have a giant robot figure who is supposed to elevate parts of the band during sort of key moments of the show.
It sound like a marionette. The band is marionettes, and the robot would then just like pull their strings and raise their arms and legs to make them perform
their crazy dance moves. If only it could make them sing.
But yes, it did raise the two measures to take back, Mark Owen and Howard Donald. But it failed to lower them again. And so Mark Owen had to continue his performance. And Howard had to continue their performance stuck in the air. Although it says later on that ladders were used to rescue Mark Owen, so continue his performance.
Right.
Which presumably means that poor old Howard Donald was settling there. Now,
so perhaps he jumped down. Perhaps he's got these amazing gymnastics and acrobatic skills. And he just leapt from the hand of the robot.
He sort of parkoured his way off the robot. That would be amazing, actually. That would be worth watching a Take That thing. Howard from Take That parkour his way off a giant robot. I mean, really, if you put that on the ticket, would you not want to go?
We could have the ante, like, with each passing week, maybe.
End up with the Mr. Blobby abseiling in.
Yeah, like, this week we're going to just stick him on top of, like, that tower that's in the middle of Seattle, and his task is to make his way to the studio by hook or by crook by the time we finish the gig.
So the gimmick of the gig is that we take Howard and we place him in some improbably hard to get difficult places. Yes. And he tries to escape. Is that just not a way of kicking me out of the band?
If we're going to throw him a continent away, we might want to consider giving him a jetpack or something. But
so the Take That thing is Mark Owen and Howard Donald, or Mark and Howard from Take That, which is doing their full name, rather than Mark Owen and Howard Donald, which is what their mum calls them. Here's a challenge for the rest of you. Can you name the remaining members of Take That without looking up on the internet?
I know is the member of Take That who's not really a member of Take That.
Oh, I'm talking about that. Robbie Williams.
Yes.
But he was performing with them. It was the first time Take That were performing back as a fivesome.
So are we suggesting that the five members of Take That back together just somehow managed to combine to cause a mechanical phone on their robot?
Well, yes. I suppose that appears to be that. The robot was so astonished. Well, the universe itself was so astonished about these two things coming that close together. So you've got three of them. Can you do the other two?
No. I've not, no idea at all. Quite like your Take That combining concept.
But their powers combined, they can break robots.
Take That are essentially the Decepticons, and have risen to take on their true form.
So you're truly saying that Decepticons have constructed Take That as a secret Autobot weapon, or a weapon against the Autobots?
Yeah, essentially.
Is this the next movie with Take That and Shia LaBeouf? They're going to come. It's a disaster movie for 2012. Take That meets the Transformers.
I was thinking more about some strange version of the Power Rangers, but they all combine at the end in a giant robot.
Oh, good grief, that would be a shocking thing to do. Talking about hoist on your own petard, Chris, do you know what a petard is?
I've got the vaguest idea. I thought it was like a tabard, you know, it was like an old item of clothing that was essentially sort of an over-the-head waistcoat from which you might reasonably be hoist.
Well, that's quite good, because often people think it's some sort of long pointy thing. It's actually a grenade. Oh. Like a
container. So you can't really be hoist by them, except for if it explodes.
Well,
so
if it explodes underneath
you
get hoist in the air in the sense of being lifted. So be hoist by your own grenade. Oh,
okay. So this is some idiot who pulled the pin and then went, oops.
What am I going to do with this? I might as well sit on it.
Butter fingers.
Oh, dear. I like to be educational on the show. You know,
We just seem to be going into computer game territory now. We've got using grenades to fry yourself upwards. And before we had parkour up a giant robot,
never
which is
attempt.
Almost the plot of a... a computer game, I think Shadows of the Colossus, I think. Well, it's not giant robots, but giant creatures, but it is effectively parkour up them.
Well, there we are then. So we've come back to something that our audience knows all about, computer games.
Yeah. So life imitates art.
Oh, that's a good little sum up there for the Take That story of them being hoist in a giant robot, life imitates art. Okay, so moving on, I believe we're going into our lovely animal section of the show, aren't we?
Yes, having extracted more philosophy than we anticipated from Take That, let's move on to something completely impervious to high thought.
So that just sounds like some sort of reaction. Some people coming up to you going, are you taking the philosophy? I'd be in Cambridge.
Oh dear.
So I believe our next story is about a sheep. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah. It's Shrek the sheep, which is a sheep in New Zealand who sadly passed away recently.
Yes, that's true. Now, why do we particularly care about this sheep, apart from that it's called Shrek, obviously? I mean, what a sheep pass away on a daily basis. So what makes this sheep important, apart from the fact it was in New Zealand?
Well, this sheep, Shrek the sheep, was the sheep who had successfully evaded shearing of any kind for an exceptionally long time. He was apparently wise to the games of the shepherds and their dogs and so forth. Was able to escape them for a very long time, to the point that he was just an enormous, great big ball of wool. Because, as it turns out, the sheep, as we know it today, has been essentially artificially selected to grow to absurd lengths of wool if you don't take measures to halt that, like, for example, farming them.
Yes, that's true. So bear in mind, kids, if you're wearing jumpers, it's genetically modified material.
But I like the fact that he's just saying it's a giant ball of wool. It's like, could they not have sent some cats after it?
Or I like to think that there was some New Zealand equivalent of Indiana Jones who set out to try and find Shrek the sheep. And all that happened, he was in a cave and suddenly this giant boulder of rolling wool came running after him and he was like running out of the thing. And he's like, okay. I found him, but I'm being chased by a giant.
But if you saw that happening, you probably wouldn't need to run away because you're going to get hit by a ball of wool and it's going to be kind of like squish, squish. Well, this is mildly irritating. You know, you could just take it.
But then you might get stuck and then you end up sort of rolling on the outside of a giant ball of fuzzy wool.
And there is a danger it's a bluff. There is a danger that it's mostly boulder and a little bit
cleverly old. Disguised look like an unshorn sheep.
Right. I mean, the inverse one is a bit weirder. If it's like a shell of rock
with a sheep inside. Running after you, going, I'm safe, I'm a sheep. Oh, no, it's a rock.
Oh, no. Well, no, quite the opposite. In this case, it's like, oh, no, it's a rock. Oh, no, I survived because it was a sheep. Excellent.
So anyway, Shrek the Sheep had not been shorn. Has this headline or this story just been made to make it hard to say on air? So Shrek the Sheep has not been shorn.
It's worth pointing out that Shaun the Sheep, the star of the Wallace and Gromit series, has not been Shrek'd in the sense that nobody has yet defined the verb to Shrek. But as and when they do, that has not happened to him.
Or may not have happened to him. The word Shrek might be to be made into a program which children love.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And Shaun the Sheep has been made into a program that children love.
I mean, you could define to Shrek to mean that which has happened to Shaun. Which is, you know, I mean, at that point you run into philosophical difficulties.
So, moving away from philosophy again, Shrek the Sheep, who was Shaun in 2004. Why am I having to say this story? This is ridiculously hard.
Let's go into Narnia years, 2004.
Yeah, so 2004. All right, so... Seven years ago, Shrek the Sheep was found and he was Shaun.
Yes.
Or they were Shaun.
This has happened. She.
And
insert joke about Shrek the Sheep being Shaun the Sheep here.
In the way that the modern media love a good old fluffy animal story, the sheep who was massively fluffy and who had escaped some sort of farm and now had a name was a massive celebrity. And so Shrek the Sheep was briefly very famous. Now Shrek the Sheep has unfortunately died, which is the story.
Alas, yes.
There is actually a picture of Shrek the Sheep on here. And
looks like Amy Winehouse.
It doesn't look like Shrek. I think it looks like a cross between a gorilla and someone that you might see, I don't know, such as like some generic soap character with awful hair.
A cross between a gorilla and some sort of horrible generic soap character with awful hair. Yet again, I'm going to say Amy Winehouse here. Mm. You know, I think mine was a quicker description. But yeah, so unfortunately Shrek the Sheep has died. And it said at the bottom here that the council are considering erecting a small statue.
Oh.
Should it have to be a big statue to fully actually get all the wool in?
Now, I'd like to think that kids should try to emulate this. I'm going to try and emulate this. So what I'm going to do is, for the next few years, I'm not going to cut my hair. And I'm going to hide away. And then at one point I'm going to come out and say, hello, I haven't cut my hair for ages, and then I'm going to have my hair cut by someone whose job it is to cut hair, and then I'm going to hope that I'm going to be as equally famous.
I think the point that you're missing is that people aren't chasing after you, generally speaking, to cut your hair.
Well, perhaps I should just go every so often and send emails to various people in authority and go, you can't cut my hair, na 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 na. Yeah,
so
I'm sure that's how you
can get this to
police.
The point that the mayor of Cambridge is running about with a pair of scissors going, where home? I'll get you.
I'm with my long hair streaking out behind me going, no, you won't. And someone with an appropriate sense of comic timing has got an iPod with the Benny Hill theme tune going on. And I'm running, I'm weaving in and out of all of the
bicycles and tourists.
All the tourists with my long hair. I like to think there's a top-down camera shot so you can see it all happening. My long hair leaves a big trail and there's a sort of like crowd of the mayor in their full regalia, yeah, with a big pair of shears going, where
you got to get it so you can see the figure of eight. Otherwise, you haven't even earned the Benny Hill theme tune. You haven't earned Yakety Sax until you've managed to run a figure of eight.
Absolutely.
Unless somebody
yes.
pursues you.
Yeah. And then we have to do that sort of thing where we're looking down a corridor and then I run across and then being chased by the mayor. And then the mayor runs across and being chased by me for no readily apparent reason.
Yes. Until the mayor goes, this isn't how this is working, and turns around.
This isn't how chases work.
They do on Scooby-Doo.
They do, yes. The other way chases work in cartoons that no one has worked out is when you've got some sort of runaway wheel or a runaway car, you're sort of running and the car's chasing you. You never think to just move to one side or the other because this thing is going in a straight line. Much like a runaway boulder.
I like on cartoon like races. They never actually have normal races where actually they stay in the same order for a while and then someone tries to overtake. What they instead have is two cars side by side, one of which is slightly ahead of the other, and then they would just kind of like move back and forth across the screen.
That's how I imagine you drive a JCB, you know. Imagine putting your hands right, in the position of two cars and move them repeatedly forward and backwards. I genuinely think that's how you drive a state JCB. You know, you just wiggle the sticks and what you want to happen happens.
That's another cartoon.
I think that's genuinely not far off. I think JCBs have two independently controlled tracks, and so you do genuinely have to go waggle, 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 waggle.
In the same way that in a car, you put your hands out in front of you and you sort of move your arms side to side to mime the steering wheel.
Ah, well. It's now my turn to be educational now. Oh, yeah. See, I looked this one up on TV Trips, which is a truly horrible time sink.
How's the PhD going, Chris?
It's going pretty well. I anticipate failure any minute. TV Trips referred to this as 50s steering, because apparently it genuinely used to be the case that your steering wheel had this massive amount of play where it didn't do anything. So if you wanted to move from having been turning slightly right to now being turning slightly left, you had to get like a 90-degree turn in there. So if you were just kind of genuinely, you know, generally speaking, hold a straight inclination, then you really did need to waggle it by 90 degrees, you know, repeatedly in order to get a little bit right, a little bit left. And then that stopped being the case, but everybody kept on thinking that's how you mime it. So everyone now thinks you're an idiot.
Is that the same way that it still seems to be a big deal to trace phone calls in American crime things, whereas now what you do is you, if you are a law enforcement agency, you click trace.
You click the big trace button.
And it says this is who it's come from.
Yeah.
Right, yes. Yeah,
I guess so, yeah.
Sort of thing. We had another email, I believe, talking about Take That, from Clem again, saying that now Take That have Robbie back, their manager may have declared a 1-in-2-out policy and rigged the robot. Now, as managers go, this is a poor policy, because 1-in-2-out is not a sustainable business
model. You will eventually run out of band until it's just the robot, which maybe is the end goal.
Are you suggesting that to make Take That fully robotic... and thus able to churn out
a single robot
cheesy
with
pop
like
songs.
Seven or eight limbs, like operating different instruments. I'd probably pay to go and see that.
Able to dance with itself in perfect synchrony.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And then with people parkouring over it.
So this would be see the robot that can dance with itself, sing in harmony, and who killed Take That.
Yeah, with like five or six like musical. Well, actually, I was going to say five or six musical instruments attached to it. This is Take That. No musical instruments were ever involved.
No, exactly. There was just a lot of going around without your shirt on.
There's no need.
And since robots don't naturally wear shirts, they're a perfect match.
You saying that robots are sort of the daring nudists of our time?
Well, when have you seen a robot with clothes on?
That is a fair point.
I see. Yeah.
Maybe robot decency should be. That'll be our theme for this week.
Is that like the fifth or sixth of the laws of robotics? No robot shall wear
trousers unless ordered, unless it contradicts the remaining three.
The third, second. Hang on a moment. So that would be unless it contradicts self-preservation. So like if the trousers were on fire, it wouldn't do that. Unless it would cause it to harm a human. So.
If
the trousers were currently on a human, then he couldn't put those on because that would harm the human in question.
Unless the trousers are on fire, and hence wear them on yourself would harm the robot but save the human.
Yeah, okay.
This is only
so they can wear trousers on fire.
So you'd have to obey the second, disobey the. No, obey the first, disobey the second. And obey the fourth. Ah, yeah, there you go.
Okay,
so and the third is to do with obeying orders given by a human. So if you told it to take its trousers off, it would have to, unless that would destroy itself or somebody else.
Now, Asimov got sort of 30 or 40 year, maybe longer career out of writing short stories based around just those three laws of robotics. Is there a possibly longer career to be made up of adding the fourth law? You know, thou shalt always wear trousers.
the epic robots and trousers.
The huge robot series that stretches over 20,000 of years where they realise this sort of of seldom found fourth law, or they introduced the fourth law because of rape of decency.
Nobody had thought of it. Ever. We've been losing wars against armies of robots. Trousers were always the solution. Every general who ever said we should tell them to take off their trousers. It's like, no, that's the stupidest solution ever. You're fired from General Academy.
Right. What do you think we should do, General Two? I think we should rave the hills with trumpets and point them at them.
Is General Academy like Fame Academy? Do you get some people that just going like...
It's like Napoleon is the guy in charge.
he says it's zombie Napoleon like we had a few weeks back.
Yeah, yeah. Zombie Napoleon takes the place of, what's his name, the spooky musical director who has been doing similar things.
Are you talking about the choir show with that ridiculously young hipster dude?
I don't know.
The least hipster.
I like how we're just like completely avoiding mentioning anything here. Just like going, here, do you mean that vague term?
Well, I can't remember. That's called the choir. I just can't remember the name of the dude.
I'm talking about Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Who's been
right,
being
yeah.
scary on talent shows and occupying that space that Simon Cowell occupies as the sort of mandatory, obnoxious individual who you need to have at the front of your show.
I kind of think that sort of sums up the difference between the BBC and the ITV, though, if you think about it. You think the ITV, you've got Simon Cowell, and the BBC have got Andrew Lloyd Webber. Does that not kind of like fit? One's a bit sort of hoary and sort of respectable, but you know, still quite threatening and imposing in national institution.
Which one was that? That's
Andrew Lloyd Webber. You know, the national institution, hoary, quite old fashioned. Okay, but you know, looking at it. And the other one's sort of like a lot older than you think it is, ridiculously well polished, and smiles like a shark, which I think sort of sums up. Yeah, not that I have a particular preference.
ITV.
Oh, ITV is a lot older than you think it is.
ITV. It's almost as old as the BBC, isn't it?
Yes, you see. I mean, that's quite old, isn't it?
But increasingly not older than he thought it was, because that's how old he thought it was.
Well, okay, you know...
I'm the one who knows.
I'm using you in the sort of generic term rather than...
I'm the exception that invalidates the rule.
Absolutely. Ah, now, do you know the... Oh, never mind. I was going to talk about the exception that proves the rule, but... No, I've done my quota of exciting did-you-know facts.
Can we move on to our last animal-related story?
I suppose we'd better, hadn't we? Otherwise, we'll run out of time altogether, and that would be sad.
Yeah, so our last animal-related story is about a shark. So moving from a sheep to a shark. And I'm not 100% sure what the point of this story is, apart from the fact that a Cornish fisherman had a shark bump his boat, and then went, blimey, a shark bumped my boat. And he told the appropriate shark authorities, and they went, blimey. Shark bumped your boat.
And then this turned into News 4 story, man-eating sharks in Cornish waters.
Yeah, well, actually, it sounds more exciting than boat-bumping sharks in Cornish waters.
So it sounds like the lowest budget Jaws sequel ever.
Jaws 6, this time it's in Cornwall. Rape me, lover.
and you ain't got
no legs on anymore.
And the shark... And the sharks just bump into boats rather than doing anything, rather than like eating people. They just make everyone wobble a bit.
So do we reckon that there is a shark radio show going out at present where the story is obnoxious fisherman bumps shark?
and drives his boat into the shark. I love that, yes. And then I also have this wonderful idea of a Cornish shark being just a sort of Cornish pasty out of the water in a sort of... dorsal fin thing. I have nowhere else to go with that, but I just had the mental image I had to share.
If they've got the radio show, does that mean they have a film which is the equivalent of Jaws, where the misunderstood shark is brutally slaughtered?
It's called Boats or something.
Oh, they're coming with a bigger boat.
Actually, there should be a set of classic films remade from the antagonist's perspective. So you imagine Jaws retold from the antagonist. So it's effectively the story about someone, a shark,
who's
hungry and then goes to effectively Sainsbury's and to get some food. And then the small bowl of pasta they're buying fights back. And then,
so when you say effectively Sainsbury's, you mean the nearest defenceless human?
I do. But I mean, small bowl of pasta is the equivalent of it. And so he goes to the small bowl of pasta and goes, thinks nothing of it. And then the pasta, they all gang up against you. And then suddenly a couple of pasta on some sort of rudimentary pasta transportation device come and stick a big explosive gas canister in your mouth. I mean, that's actually like a zombie film, but with pasta. In fact, I should pitch that. It's like a zombie film, but with
pasta.
It'll
be a terrible advertising campaign for Sainsbury's.
But no,
I don't know.
God. I do like this. Like, we could just tell. Just think of all the classic movies that we could tell from, if only the other side. You know, kind of like Star Wars, looking like by Darth Vader's point of view. It's kind of like, oh.
Wouldn't that be episodes 1, 2, and 3?
No, you know what I mean.
Yes, the original ones.
I'm ignoring the existence of episodes 1 through 3.
That's a wise choice.
But no, just it's like, oh, why is my son so whiny and he keeps on like telling me to.
Just because I left him on a planet for 20 years.
I didn't know he existed. It's 17. Not my fault.
That's true, yeah. But lots of everyone's thinking of different films now, aren't they? Classic films. Back to the Future. Who's the antagonist in Back to the Future? I suppose time itself.
Biff.
That's true. Well, poor old Biff, right? We've all been stupid as kids. He appears to have stupidity as a genetic trait, unfortunately.
And he keeps on ending up in manure.
He does. And then he tries to do exactly what Michael J. Fox does. So Michael J. Fox has got a rubbish life in the future. So he goes back in the future, subjective to 1955, like in 1985, which is our subjective past. So in the subjective past, which is also the 50s subjective future, he has a rubbish life. And so he goes back in time, does some messing around on the timeline, comes back and has got a great life where he's like a lot richer and his family a lot better. Now, Biff does that in like Back to the Future 2. He's got a rubbish life in the what's subjectively our future, but only just. And goes back in time to what's definitely subjectively our past and 1985's past, fixes it, comes back in time, and suddenly he's the bad guy.
I've never seen Back to the Future. So you have no idea how little sense that previous paragraph meant to me.
Well, there is someone out there going, oh, you're right, Biff was just misunderstood.
Well, there we go. That's coming soon, a series of films by Burst of Bubble.
I feel so, yes. I think whilst we debate the morality of Back to the Future between ourselves, and perhaps I go and briefly read IMDb so I can figure out what Rich just said, it's time for another quick musical break, after which we'll be back and talking about some more silly news stories. We'll be back in a bit.
On air, online and across Cambridge. Your station, your Cam FM.
Hello and welcome back to Burst the Bubble on 97.2 Cam FM with me, Chris Moten, and my regular co-host, Michael Quintero.
Hello.
And our guest this week, Mr. Richard Wareham.
Hello.
We've been talking about silly news stories, although we're going to take a very brief break from that, to mention Cam FM's Suicide Sunday Party. They're going to be partying down at Vodka Revolution between 9 and 3 tonight, where you can expect barbecue and shisha, and also a slightly contradictory free barbecue.
Although on the poster it does say free barbecue Little Star.
Little Star. The Little Star turns out to mean that for the first 50 people through the door before 10 o'clock, you can get a free barbecue item or a shot if you don't care for a barbecue item. So get there early in order to cash in on that one.
I believe it only costs £3 to enter.
I believe that is so, yes.
Which is the important thing to say, rather than have low people expecting their free barbecue for actual free.
For actual free, yes. I'm facing the slight obstacle that the microphone faces the other way from the poster. So my role here is to get Rich to say things.
Oh, well, I can also say the other thing. It says UV paint and free glow sticks. And the free glow sticks don't have a little star.
Ah.
So that probably means,
that's true. Genuine free. That's the real free.
Did you ever wonder, like, in the future, when archaeologists dig up things with our dead language on, they might think that little star was just our punctuation mark for lie. Yeah, we have an exclamation mark for when you're shouting. We have a full stop when you're talking over. A question mark for you saying a question. Just star meant, and this isn't true.
This would be like that punctuation mark that was proposed to mean sarcasm.
Oh, yeah, the sarcasm mark for Americans.
Yeah.
like that would work.
Americans and idiots.
Yeah, like that would work.
That's cool. I don't know.
We have an email.
Yes. An anonymous correspondent says, we should definitely commission Inception, told from the point of view of the guy who is asleep. Now, as far as I'm aware, much of that film is spent with all the participants asleep.
That's true.
A fairly ambiguous
I believe they commission. I believe they mean that the main guy whose dreams everyone else is going into.
So in actual fact, that is, it already is, because we're seeing it from his dream. So we're seeing what he's experiencing.
Unless we see a completely non-supernatural film from his point of view, in which we just see him go to bed and then wake up and go, whoa, I should probably sell my father's empire.
That's true. Actually.
It would be quite. It would be an art film, I suppose.
That would actually be more from the point of view of the air stewardess, whose entire job on that film, I believe, was to connect all these people up to this mysterious-looking device, them sleep for 10 hours.
So this is where, she goes and like plays solitaire on her phone, and then sort of occasionally looks back and goes, "Yep, still seems to be dozing."
I think her phone might have to be twitched off in flight.
Ah, true, true.
Now we've got 4 minutes, basically.
We have 4 minutes. 6 minutes.
Sorry, I can't.
Six of your human minutes are available
for one more story.
For one more story,
which is kind of also one story in two parts.
It is. Yeah,
true.
This first hit the news when a Freedom of Information request was sent to Leicester's council, asking them if the city was prepared for a zombie invasion.
Now, I believe you already covered this on Best of All, haven't you? This particular story. Perhaps it was another comedy podcast I was listening to.
We've covered many zombie stories in the past, this one was in the last fortnight and we weren't on last week.
Cool. Well, I just assumed it was the sort of thing to cover. Yeah, so, in the original story, Leicester responded to the Freedom of Information request and said, "I'm afraid we're woefully underprepared for zombies." And the BBC took this and went, oh gosh, look at this.
In their reply, they actually said, "We were quite amused by your request."
Exactly.
Which is nice because it shows that there is a human face to Leicester Council.
Irony, thy name is the British public, as I would say. That sounded like a proper noun, but that was just me saying another thing. Irony, thy name is the British public. The British public as a whole took this story and ran with it and said, "Well, in which case, we better make a zombie attack happen in Leicester just so that we can show up the shoddy preparations for it."
And so over like 150 people formed a flash mob of zombies, which went and pressed up against the glass of the city council building in the way that zombies are wont to do. However, the glass did not then spontaneously break under the pressure of all these zombie bodies behind it.
So what we actually learned is that Leicester is perfectly well prepared for a zombie attack, because one happened, and the solution turned out to be what they did, which is to say, just ignore them, they'll go away eventually.
Yes, because the glass is sufficient to keep zombies out.
As it turns out, yes.
There was a quote from a passerby who said, "People were going about their normal routine when all of a sudden a steady horde of zombies came lumbering into view," he said. "It was astonishing how everyone just seemed to stop and stare. Of course, if it had been a real zombie attack, I think folk would be running for their lives." Now, how do you tell at a distance if it is a flash mob versus a real zombie attack? What's the tell?
Yeah, like if you have the most convincing possible flash mob,
to be properly convincing as a flash mob, surely you need like people flash mobbing as zombie victims as well, who would then get overrun by the zombie horde. But the problem with that is, if it's a flash mob, how are the zombies going to tell that they're meant to be attacking these people who will become ready victims? It becomes less flash mob and more just mob.
Mob attacking.
I think the clue is in the name. Flash mob, flash photography. Ah. Take a photo. Whip your camera out and take a photo. If it's a bunch of pesky students, they'll immediately strike a pose. If it's zombies, they'll eat you. So if you find that there's like teeth in your shoulder shortly after you do that, then you're in trouble. Otherwise, it's pesky students. Carry on about your business.
So it's like, you can't take a photo of a vampire because they don't have an image.
Yeah.
And you can't take a photo of a zombie because it won't pose for you.
Right. Well,
but if you can take a photo,
you'll regret having done so.
If you can take a photo of it, it's a student.
Yes.
You
can't take a photo of a student properly in character. Like the act of taking the photo causes them to immediately break character
and go.
I'm just imagining a Scooby-Doo episode themed around this, like trying to distinguish between the real zombies and the fake zombies.
Have you ever thought what it would be like if Scooby-Doo was like real life? You'd run really fast and just the same chest of drawers would go past you time and time and time again. And you'd stop and you'd realise you'd actually gone nowhere, but the space was circular.
So it'd be quite useful if you realised you'd left a 20 in the chest of drawers.
Exactly.
So you'd run past them, sort of removing the 20 from each one.
Have you ever ran down the corridor in Newnham? Just for the hell of it.
Naked, but we never talk about that.
I can imagine that being a similar sort of feeling. It's just like you keep running and passing doors.
I know. Funnily enough, having strange men running around down the corridors of Newnham is frowned upon these days. I don't know why. You tend to get the porters called on you.
Is this a sort of it's a mark of a certain phase of life?
The point when the
Newnham porters decide that you're no longer harmless and must be hunted down.
Yeah, unfortunately, actually, that phase of life happened to be the moment I arrived in Cambridge.
No, I'd like to. I want to know where this platform concept is going to be extended to anything that that any freedom of information requests that suggests that somewhere isn't prepared for something. So it's kind of like, are some people going to go and like pretend to be mutants caused by radiation? If they
I see. Go? I think both Chris and I, and I can see this advisor thinking there. I wonder if the Cambridge Council is prepared for a large group of naked women running around. I can see it in your eyes, Chris. Don't lie to me.
I think they'll see through our Facebook event. So, yeah, okay. So it's going to get trickiest once you move this to the, you know, like, Cambridge is unprepared for a tornado. Quick, tornado flash mob. And there'll just be lots of people walking around doing, like, interpretive dance.
You know, sort
of
tornado.
Tornado.
Cambridge is probably also unprepared for a large number of Godzilla attacks. Parallel Godzilla attack.
So you're going to discover Godzilla by goading him on Facebook.
Exactly. Well, you know, he'll be there somewhere.
I hear Cambridge is up for it. I hear it's not going to work.
Well, you hear
I bet there's no big mutant lizards going to turn up.
You hear about those Facebook stories all the time, like people accidentally inviting the world to their parties and they come along. It would just be that for Godzilla.
You accidentally invited Godzilla. Exactly. You idiot.
Ooh, where am the mayor will be chasing me around Cambridge.
Godzilla is chasing him.
Benny Hill. And if we go in a figure of eight, that's definitely Benny Hill. Worthy.
Oh dear. Well, on that note, our time is up for this week. We'll be back with more Burst the Bubble on a future occasion. Will we be bubble bursting next week, Michael? Or
hopefully
we'll be bubble bursting this time next week, so join us then. For now, we return you to Cam FM's inimitable collection of music. Goodbye.